Why settle for just living a good life when you can live a life optimized to achieve your human potential? Learn all the hacks that will transform your life from average to extraordinary. Welcome to Life Optimized with functional medicine expert, Dr. Neil Palvin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Life Optimized podcast, where we discuss how to optimize health, life, sports, and your overall well-being. I am Dr. Neil Palvin, and we are excited to welcome another great guest, a fellow New Yorker, Dr. Sharp, who is the medical director and CEO of Health Meets Wellness here in Manhattan. And we are going to be discussing how you can use natural approaches, diet, and some medicines to help treat PCOS, autoimmune conditions, and find other natural approaches to the conditions that you may be experiencing. She has incredible amount of experience, and I am going to let Dr. Sharp in a moment, has a very long and glorious resume. I'm going to let her tell us about herself and how she ended up finding and developing. I saw her space, which is amazing here, and I let her tell us about herself and how she ended up kind of has a merged practice in terms of helping women with weight loss and a lot of other health issues. So Dr. Sharp, thanks for coming on and tell us about yourself. How did you end up owning your own practice and developing the core of Health Meets Wellness?
Oh, well, Neil, thank you so much for that warm introduction. I'm very excited to be here and be joining you on your podcast. So to start off a little bit about myself. So I'm an internal medicine physician. I had a personal interest in functional medicine after residency. I started doing a lot of gut health in my typical practice and primary care. And then that kind of opened the door to functional medicine for me. I ended up getting certified by IFM, or Institute for Functional Medicine. And now I started my own practice where I combine what I believe to be are the three important pillars of health, which are medicine, exercise, and nutrition. So my practice called Health Meets Wellness, the name was actually very intentional because my goal with the practice is to blend health and wellness. So I saw that as kind of a gap, actually, where I feel as though a lot of wellness is kind of siloed in one area and then health and medicine is siloed in another. And I think that those should really be married together. And so that's what I'm doing in my practice.
Explain that a little more. Why and what is that gap, and what do you find that patients are looking for that's not being met in the market? Is it that they're not having fitness incorporated into it? Is that the doctors have the 12 minutes per patient who are taking insurance and just don't have the time to delve into it? What is that donut hole, and how are you helping kind of fill the donut hole? Actually, probably we're doing functional medicine, so we have to do healthy food, but yeah.
Yeah, so I would say, I know I was trying to think of something healthy in a donut shape, but nothing comes to mind. But anyway, so I would say a couple of things. So you hit a couple of points already, which is one, you know, practicing functional medicine often does take longer visit times and more frequent visits. So that's one thing that I'm really excited about being able to do in my practice. The second is, I would say, I'll give an example. So I would have patients coming in all the time with a bag of supplements and a list of tests that they wanted ordered from their nutritionist or dietitian or holistic medical practitioner. And having that done in an asynchronous way where the labs are being done, then I'm giving them their results, they're seeing the other provider, and we're not really co-managing the condition, I think is just ripe for either over-treatment, misdiagnosis, and also I think it's just not really the best possible care that anyone could be getting. And so I really solved that in this practice because we're a membership model-based practice, and I designed it that way because I really want everyone that comes in the door to experience the entire practice. I found, because I worked in other practices where things are a little bit more a la carte, and then people just don't really want to pay to go see the dietitian or to do an exercise assessment or things like that because it's yet another add-on or another thing. And so I just wanted everything to be seamless and easy and then part of the package because I really believe that they all should be combined. And so in that way, being able to understand how exercise is impacting your biometrics, how what you're eating is impacting your symptoms and your biometrics, and also just how you're feeling overall has been so powerful. And I think that it's an exciting way to practice. And quite frankly, I really think it is the way that medicine should be practiced. The problem is that insurances, as you highlighted, don't reimburse appropriately for all of that care. So hoping to bridge that gap.
No, I totally agree. I've so much easier when I've learned, and other doctors I talk to, I'm sure same with you, is yeah, when you have everything as much you can under one roof, and the patient kind of it seamlessly flows, it works just so much easier. Otherwise, I sometimes feel like a tour director or something where, okay, you're going to see so and so for this and this for that, and it's great when you have that you have everything kind of under one roof, so you can control and you have your plan followed through. Now, I know you mentioned a couple of times like biometrics and numbers. I know that's part of your practice.
Yeah.
I always tell patients, we can't really treat what we don't know.
Yeah.
So I know that's part of your protocol as well. So how do you incorporate data? Is data the first thing that you're looking at? Or is it, again, I know you have different buckets that you're looking at when somebody comes initially into the practice, but how important is the data for you?
Yeah, so I love what you just said about you can't really treat what you don't know, because I love to be data driven. And look, you can treat symptoms, you know what the symptoms are, but much better to treat the root cause if you can identify it, right? And so I think that the more data you have, the better diagnosis you can make, and then the better treatment plan you can have. So a lot of the diagnostics that we use in this practice are, number one, use laboratory testing, so all the basic labs. We also do expanded testing for gut microbiome testing, food sensitivity testing. We really work with patients in terms of doing an elimination diet or a modified elimination diet, which actually gives us a lot of great data. And it's actually been kind of fun with some patients to see how that actually lines up perfectly with some of the expanded testing that we've ended up doing, which you don't necessarily need to do both. It depends on the patient, obviously, but it's been interesting to see how diagnostic the modified elimination diet can be. We do strength assessments so we can really understand how the exercise routines that we recommend are impacting your overall strength. And then that obviously correlates with longevity. And also, maintenance of lean muscle mass. We have a body composition machine in the office. And so I love that machine because I think oftentimes people can get really fixated on a number, so the weight, but weight is really a crude measurement in terms of your body composition when it doesn't take into account your body fat percentage, your lean muscle mass, and things like that, which are more important to track than the actual weight number. And then in addition, we have an app, a member app that I created. And so the data that I can get from that in terms of meal tracking and tracking your exercise is also really powerful, and then helps with positive feedback and health coaching to help people achieve and maintain their health and wellness goals. So love data, trying to incorporate it more. And one other thing that I actually didn't mention that I really like incorporating, and I'm actually wearing one right now, is a continuous glucose monitor. So obviously glucose isn't everything, but I think that it can be really helpful in terms of helping to guide nutrition plans and make them personalized.
So you're actually able to track your patients. Is it manually entered for them? If okay, I ate two, I had a broccoli and a salad and a piece of chicken. Is it that specific where you're able to see what they're eating per meal? Is that something that goes between you and your nutritionist?
Well, so the way that the practice works is after you see our dietitian, Elle, she actually creates a meal plan that then is put into the app. And so you see both a photo of the meal, you see the nutrition facts. If you want, we can toggle that on and off. And then you can track if you ate that meal or that snack, if you had your hydration recommendation for the day, or you can select, I ate something different, and then you could log what you ate if it was not the meal that was recommended.
Patients who are looking for that, and it's some of the things that we're going to delve into in terms of how you manage some chronic conditions that aren't easily managed, that's really important for patients to know, you because you're looking at what they're eating. You're going to add, like you mentioned, you're going to take that information, combine that with what their testing data shows, and you can personalize a plan, which is great about functional integrative medicine, as opposed to, again, that 12-minute doctor visit, which we're going to continue to comment on in a whatever way, not a positive way. And I'll just throw this in now. The rest of the week that myself and Dr. Sharp mentioned, this is not to be construed as medical advice. You definitely need to follow up with your individual provider and understand. I know most physicians do treat patients in other states. Laws, state by state, do vary. So there is our little caveat. We've got it out of the way. Now we don't have to say it anymore. So I want to, again, with some of the things that we're going to talk about in terms of things, PCOS and weight issues, everything seems to revolve around the gut. You mentioned that you do microbiome testing as well as food sensitivity testing, which is probably in the functional world the most, to me, is the most controversy behind it. There are people who think it's the best thing ever, and there's other people who think it's has no data, what, like, it's not consistent either way. So how do you use and how do you construe, we'll do the food sensitivity testing first. How do you use it in your practice? Do you think it's gospel? What is your opinion and how do you use food sensitivity testing?
I would say first things first, it's really important to understand what you're testing, right? So if you're doing IgE testing, which is the type of antibody that actually has to do with an allergy then or an allergic response, it's going to be a more immediate response. You're going to have more severe symptoms, you know, hives, potentially shortness of breath, things of that nature. That's a serious thing. It definitely would be important to test for. You may need, you know, a patient might need an EpiPen or something like that. That is definitely not to be misconstrued with a food sensitivity. And so I totally agree with you that it, there is a little bit of a gray area there in the sense of, you know, a lot of the symptoms can be a little bit hard to decipher or to discern, you know, brain fog, fatigue, they're delayed, right? So it can be hard to identify the specific trigger. And so doing some food sensitivity testing and looking for IgG antibodies, which can be more specific for food sensitivities, is definitely one thing that I think can be very helpful. I also am a big believer in the modified elimination diet. I will rely more on blood testing or food sensitivity testing through I would say laboratory testing when patients are not open to doing a modified elimination diet, because I think that that's really the best way to test how your body responds to the food that you're eating and what those sensitivities are. And when I say modified elimination diet, I typically prescribe that because a typical true elimination diet is extremely hard to follow. And I think it's a little bit challenging for most people and it's not very approachable. So doing the modified elimination diet, cutting foods out for at least 2 weeks, so you allow those IgG levels to reduce to a very low level and then reintroduce some of those foods, you can actually have a very good response and you can identify then those specific food triggers. And I think that that data is very powerful. So in terms of if it's gospel or not, I would say I definitely would rely heavily on that, especially because I think one thing I try to encourage patients to lean into is that you know your body best, right? So like if you eat something and you don't feel well after you eat it, that's how you feel, right? That's data. So I think that that's important. And so I say that to say, like, sometimes, you know, you can get a food sensitivity panel back from the lab and it says that, oh, I'm not sensitive to, or someone will say, I'm not sensitive to this food, but I thought I was. And I will still say, well, if you don't feel good when you eat it, then I would recommend not eating it.
No, that's the gold standard. Yeah. If you feel bloated or have brain fog, if you eat gluten, then you're, no matter what the test say, you're gluten sensitive. That's the gold standard, but it's helpful.
Yeah.
If you see, hey, you're allergic to strawberry, you're sensitive to strawberries and you have those symptoms, then again, that's the easiest way to do it.
Yeah.
So explain to me, you mentioned, so when you do an elimination diet, again, this is something that's become much more individual. Are you removing at the same time? Are you doing dairy, gluten, seeds and nuts? Or how deep, how restrictive of a elimination diet are you doing? Are you do a piece like step by step?
Yeah. So, you know, I definitely take an individualized approach with everyone. So I would say like for some people, if there are foods that they think that they might be sensitive to and they want to test those off the bat, maybe we'll come up with a list of those foods and remove them initially. But I would say most typically, especially if I'm doing it more for gut related symptoms, I'll usually go through the FODMAPs acronym and cut out each one of those sections. So like, for example, the D in FODMAPs being dairy, I would cut, or actually disaccharides, but I usually just say dairy for patients because it makes it easier. But I would say I would cut disaccharides out, let's just say for 2 weeks, and then add back in things from that food group while you're eliminating another one. So you can do it in like a progressive way so that you can work your way through the FODMAPs. Those, I would say, are an easy set of food groups because they include most of the common triggers for people in terms of their food sensitivity. So I usually do it that way. And by doing it in a modified way where it's 2 weeks for every one of those groups, you can cut things out in a stepwise fashion. It doesn't feel so restrictive. The goal also, I would say, with any elimination diet, and this is what can get a little bit tricky, is that you should cut the foods out and then add them back in a systematic way, with the goal of understanding your dose response relationship so that you can still eat a healthy, balanced diet with eating as many types of foods or as much variety as possible, but not tipping the scale in terms of the dose that's going to actually elicit a response.
Totally agree with that approach. So again, we mentioned, keep saying that gut's related. We're going to talk about now how, in terms of the, we're going to get into a big picture here in a second, but relating to the microbiome, how, again, this is, I think the microbiome is going to be part of the bigger future of how we treat a lot of the conditions that we're going to talk about. So what is your, where are you at now in terms of how much do you use the importance of microbiome testing, trying to correct the microbiome as part of your practice?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say that I would love to be able to do even more microbiome and gut testing, but we're restricted in New York State by some of the tests that we can order.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. So, but putting that aside, I try to use the tests that are approved in New York State as much as possible. And I would say that it is really helpful. And I think that it's the next big thing that we all should be looking at in testing. I think the gut microbiome has a huge role in terms of your immune system, regulating your T regulatory cells, and your immune system in terms of autoimmune conditions, I think is obviously a clear trigger and place that we want to focus. I think it also is really important to consider how your gut microbiome could be impacting your mood and the gut-brain axis. I think it's also important to understand how the gut microbiome can be impacting constipation, bloating, symptoms of that nature. And in addition, also absorption, right? So when you have a gut microbiome that's not healthy, you actually have a harder time absorbing things that you need from your food because of the types of bacteria that are more prevalent in your gut. So I think it's really multifactorial in terms of the impact of your gut and your overall health. And we're really just at the tip of the iceberg of it in terms of how we can use that data. And obviously when we can get more of it in terms of the testing, it's more helpful.
Exactly. It's coming. I think it's coming. So now I keep hinting at it. So let's talk. I mean, I know one of the big aspects of your practice is helping women with polycystic ovarian syndrome, which I think the last study data I saw, I think is about 10% of menstruating females have PCOS and have symptoms. And it drives me crazy that pretty much the answer for traditional physicians, oh, just go on birth control pills and you'll be fine, which I think to me, I don't like. I'm not going to speak for anybody else. I think it just causes more issues. So what is your core approach? I know obviously the first answer is going to be data in terms of understanding, helping. And I think part of it's educating women that come into your practice what PCOS is and that it's not something that has to be life altering.
So I think a couple of things, you know, you highlighted a few important things. One being that, you know, there's kind of like a traditional internal medicine way of diagnosing and then managing PCOS. And I think, you know, PCOS definitely has a personalized approach in terms of the diagnostic criteria, because everyone's diagnostic criteria could be a little bit different in terms of whether, you know, polycystic ovaries are seen on imaging and ovulation, or if there's hirsutism. So, you know, the different constellation of symptoms is definitely important to recognize so that you can treat the symptoms and the root cause. So I definitely try to do more of a root cause analysis as opposed to just like ending with the diagnosis of PCOS at the onset. And then secondly, I would say that I think, you know, taking a more holistic approach to management, I think like, you know, the kind of like standard management would probably be like a oral contraceptive, spironolactone, metformin, right? Like, that treats a lot of the symptoms of PCOS, but or that regimen. And while it's a good protocol, I think that there's a lot more that you could potentially do. In particular, I would say focusing on the gut microbiome, focusing on hormone balance, focusing maybe on weight management, focusing on stress management. All of those things can be really important in terms of treating PCOS. I would say, just to use a case as an example, because it's fun to use cases, I had a patient who came in to see me had PCOS. She met criteria for GLP-1 medication with an obese BMI. And she also had IBS-C and constipation. And we treated the constipation before starting the GLP-1 because that's a potential adverse effect from the medication. But then we ended up treating all of her other symptoms, including fatigue, actually, and the irregular menses that goes with PCOS, with just treating the root cause of her obesity. And so the hormone, I was actually on metformin and I took her off of that before starting the GLP-1. And it was just amazing to see the results with treating one condition with one medication. We treated everything else. Now, we did dietary modifications. We did exercise. So we actually did a lot of other things that didn't involve medication, but that actually are treatment protocols. And so I think it's taking that multi-pronged approach, which is what my practice really allows. So we were able to do the medical component. Then we were able to make dietary recommendations. We made strength assessment recommendations and exercise protocol, including resistance training to maintain lean muscle mass. And then ultimately, you know, empowering this patient with her health, because the goal is for her to have long-term lasting results and feel like she understands what's going on in her body and has the tools to maintain looking and feeling her best.
Love it. I want to unpack a couple of things for people who are listening out there. So first thing I think is probably the most important, or actually they're all important, but is the fact that there's not, and I see patients I hear about, there are multiple types of PCOS out there. There's different categories, and your doctor should be trying to put the pieces together there. If they're not, find another doctor. I'm pretty blunt about that at this point. And you don't have, and there is one category where you do not have cysts on your ovary to be considered PCOS. So people need to be aware of that. Second one, for people who don't know, GLP-1s are the new super meds, Mounjaro, Ozempic. I know that, and Wegovy, again, there's little differentiations we'll get into a little bit later, but they do have incredible power. And the last piece that, again, I think is the biggest take home from what you said is, again, there are treatments for PCOS. It's not something where, you're not just going to be birth control and metformin the rest of your life if you hit what the root causes are, and everybody's individual. And it's not like the traditional medicine where everybody kind of views PCOS as a kind of a cookie cutter program. And that's what's great about what you're doing is that you're getting to the deep cause, the root cause, and treating everybody as an individual. So I'm off my soapbox now, and let's go into a little deeper dive into, so what are the symptoms that women are normally going to show when they have PCOS? That is, tends to be kind of a common batch of four or five different things. So what should women be looking for and talking to their doctor about if they think they have PCOS?
Yeah. So, I mean, irregular menses or anovulation, meaning like very, very long periods of time between, or maybe not ovulating at all, that would be a big red flag or key indicator that there might be something going on with hormonal imbalance. You know, weight is an interesting one, because being overweight and, you know, I would say weight retention in general tends to be something that we think of as being a diagnostic criteria for, or not diagnostic, but a criteria for, you know, suggesting PCOS. However, now I've definitely seen it in women who don't necessarily meet that criteria. But the same goes for the hirsutism. So, you know, abnormal hair growth in terms of being in a more male pattern of hair growth, especially with like facial hair and things of that nature. In addition, I would say acne is another one. And that, you know, can be a little bit of a tough one, because there's a lot of things that you can do to treat acne. And so if you can control that symptom, sometimes then it's not as obvious in terms of being related to a bigger constellation of symptoms and in the diagnosis of PCOS. Mood disturbances is another thing to consider. Fatigue and insulin resistance is a big thing. So that's a sign in terms of something that we would actually test for, right? But that's something that I think is showing up more and more, and that can be seen in people with different BMIs, right? And so it's important to kind of recognize that as a potential flag for PCOS.
And what are you using to evaluate your patients for insulin resistance?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I usually would always do standard blood work initially, right? So I would ideally do fasting insulin level, fasting glucose level, hemoglobin A1C. And as I mentioned before, I also do like using continuous glucose monitors. And so that is like the best insight in terms of what patient's average blood sugar level really is, and if there might be an underlying level of insulin resistance. So that's kind of fun. I mean, that's not the gold standard, but I think in terms of clinical practice, it also helps patients kind of identify what might be going on, because insulin resistance can, you know, be a very challenging to treat when you're not treating the root cause, and it can actually make it hard for patients to lose weight. It can result in that hormone imbalance. It can be challenging in terms of energy levels, and it can set them up for increased risk of more chronic diseases down the road. So I feel like, you know, as you said, finding someone who's willing to do a more expanded workup and to really figure out what's going on can have, you know, a humongous impact on health long term.
That's interesting. So how do you use the CGM to look at their insulin levels? You look at spikes the whole day. What's the highlight of what you're looking for in the CGMs?
I misspoke in terms of saying that the CGM is going to actually like give us data on the insulin levels per se, except for it's a correlate for it, right? In the sense of like if you have a resting or average blood sugar level that's above average, then it suggests that you're going to have an elevated insulin level because when we test your A1C, we know that that's your average blood sugar level over 3 months because that's the lifespan of a red blood cell, and we're measuring the glucose on the red blood cell. And so similarly, we can get some of that data in real time with the continuous glucose monitor that, when your average blood sugar level tends to be in the pre-diabetic range, typically you have a level of insulin resistance. So it's a correlate, but I just like it because it's instant feedback. And I think that it's easier for patients and for people to kind of digest that because they can see it happening in real time.
Gotcha. That makes per yeah. It's definitely nice. It's nice added on information. So I brought it up, and I know I see it in your social media a lot that you talk a lot about. We mentioned already the GLP-1 medication. So when patients now, of any medicine out there, I think patients have their own preconceptions of what the GLP-1s are going to do, and they see everything from celebrities, Kim Kardashian, to so on and so forth on it. So how do you A, temper patients' expectations, and how do you explain to patients how you're going to use them? And then we can go a little more into the biology beyond that. But that to me is the biggest one of the biggest things out there is, again, there's no I don't know many other medications where patients come in telling you, I want this because it's going to do this, and then you have to kind of say, okay, let's take a step back here. So how do you handle that? Because it's in the media more than anything else.
Patients are very responsive to an informed plan, right? So when you provide data for why you want to use the medication or not, I think it can be really powerful. One of the best tools that I use to explain why a medication might be, I would say, recommended or not would be using the body composition machine. And the biggest thing that I talk about in terms of weight loss medications, when used correctly, are amazing in terms of treating the root cause, helping patients overcome some hormonal imbalance and really activating weight loss and lipolysis or fat burning and helping with insulin resistance, quieting food noise, especially for people who have that as one of the, I would say, triggers for maybe their weight issues. But I would say the key, and this is why, again, I love the medicine, exercise, and nutrition approach, is that I say, no matter what, if you take this medication, it is not a magic bullet. Because if you take the medication and you don't make any changes, then you're going to end up in a worse place than you were when you come off the medication. And the reason is you're going to have higher body fat percentage, lower lean muscle mass, lower basal metabolic rate, which is the number of calories you need to just like exist right before you do any activity. And then when you regain weight, which you will, because you've made no positive changes in terms of your diet and lifestyle, you're going to actually gain more fat and then have a harder time losing the weight in the future. So I think when you frame it that way, people are not going to be as excited about taking the medication if it's not done in a way where you can actually track lean muscle mass. You can know that you're losing weight the way that you should be. You're decreasing visceral fat, gaining lean muscle, losing body fat percentage. I mean, that's really powerful data, not to mention, monitoring all the biometrics and things like that. So I think that's why it's so powerful to really combine the diet, exercise, and nutrition.
I love it. If people, it's not a detour. It's not a lazy medicine. It's not something, okay, I'm just gonna not exercise and sleep all day and eat tacos and pizza and I'm gonna look great in my bikini. That's not what it's gonna do. And like you said, there's rebound effects, and that's what some of the studies are showing. So I totally agree with that approach.
Yeah, and one of the things too, I mean, in my patient case that I brought up, I definitely kind of like sweeped over the dietary modifications that were made as well. But I think it's important to recognize that there's a lot that can be done with diet, not only just in terms of calories, but in understanding like what your needs are in terms of micronutrients and macronutrients, but also understanding like what types of things you might want to add into the diet to help treat some symptoms while you're treating the medical disease process. For example, to go back to PCOS for a minute, you can add in like high omega fatty acids or omega-3 fatty acids to help with inflammation and to help with some hormone balance. You can add in other things in terms of I would probably recommend seeds and potentially I would say ginger if you have GI symptoms that are related to help with gut healing and also inflammation. I would probably add in depending on the patient again, but maybe a probiotic. I would do specific strains that have been researched for this specific condition. So whether we're treating like rheumatoid arthritis or PCOS, there are different probiotic strains. I would probably add in different types of vegetables that might treat that specific condition. And all that stuff will make a huge difference in terms of how the patient's feeling while they're on the medication or not.
What are you using these medications for besides weight loss? I know you mentioned PCOS. Are there any other conditions that you're using them for now in your practice?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so primarily they're definitely used for weight loss. And I'd say like I try to be mindful of understanding and having the patient understand that while we are treating, let's say, to use the same patient, but treating her obesity, we're also treating this other condition. And so I really like using medications where you can treat multiple things with one medication or one supplement. And so I would say when I'm using them to treat something other than just an obese BMI, I'm using that in combination. I'm using it to basically treat two things at once, right? So the weight management in terms of patients that meet the criteria based on, overweight BMI with a comorbid condition or obesity, and then let's say PCOS. Maybe binge eating disorder and the appropriate, conditions, potentially insulin resistance or prediabetes while you're still treating, obviously, the overweight or obesity. But those things, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, those are all things that can actually be managed with weight loss and diet and exercise when done the right way. Not for everybody, but it's possible. And I think that's what's important to kind of take into account as well.
You brought it up a couple of times, and it interlocks with almost everything that we're going to be talking about in terms of body measurements, and you have the unit in your office that helps measure those things. So explain to people who don't know, it's becoming more and more common now, but explain to people what the device is measuring and then why it's important in helping them get better and then maintain their health as they move on in the future.
The body composition machine, I like for a couple of reasons. One, it just gives so much more data in terms of your overall health. So, the BMI is a very rudimentary measurement of weight for height, and we use this to classify people in terms of whether they're overweight, obese, or quote unquote normal weight. Doesn't take into account the transcultural approach that we should take. There's a lot of studies that show that certain populations are actually overweight or obese with a BMI of 23 or above. And so I think it's important to highlight that BMI is not a perfect measure. That there's always the idea of like a skinny fat person, right, where they have a low BMI but a high body fat percentage that is in the abdominal region has higher correlations with cardiovascular disease and metabolic disease, and untreated leaves patients at a very high risk of these chronic medical conditions and could go untreated because it doesn't meet the criteria for management, for example, right? And so when you can actually look at lean muscle mass, visceral fat, body fat percentage, not only can you measure changes while you're undergoing a therapeutic plan, right, with diet and exercise and medicine, but you can also track markers of disease. Like I mentioned, visceral fat, which I would say is a much better marker of risk of cardiovascular disease or metabolic disease than BMI alone.
So yeah, for those listening, visceral fat is simply like fat around the organs, and there, like Dr. Sharp mentioned, definitely is an increased risk of metabolic issues and other medical issues, pretending can lead to other medical issues. So when somebody comes in, they have a high visceral fat. Are you having them on a specific protocol? Is it mostly exercise and weight loss? How do you explain to somebody, because again, it's not, they know BMI a lot of times now, but they don't know what visceral fat is. How do you explain it to the patients, and then what type of program are you initiating with somebody when they do have visceral fat, either on their own or as part of whatever they're coming to see you for?
I would say I definitely take a personalized approach. So I know I've said that a lot, and I hate to keep harping on
That is the theme of this episode. Yes. Personalized
it.
approach. No, nothing cookie cutter. That's bad. Bad cookie cutter.
Well, and so I'll just give an example. So if someone comes in and they have an obese BMI and a high visceral fat level, then I would recommend a comprehensive medicine, exercise, and nutrition plan, and potentially consider a weight loss medication depending on the patient, right? If someone comes in and they have a normal BMI and they have a normal body fat percentage with a more elevated visceral fat, which would be surprising but possible, then I would probably recommend more intensive diet and exercise modifications to try to target that visceral fat. For example, I think there are a lot of things in our diet that we don't really recognize as being triggers for high cholesterol and increased visceral fat. So, one thing I would say is I would definitely recommend more of a healthy fat, so like a Mediterranean style diet, so not low fat, full fat, but full of healthy fats like salmon, avocado, walnuts, those sorts of things, olive oil. I might focus on, the ways that they're cooking. Are they using oils that are appropriate for high heat? Are they, using olive oil as a finishing oil, for example, so they can still get the antioxidant benefits of the olive oil when they're cooking? Are there other things that we can do in their diet, little things that could help improve in terms of inflammation and fat? I would also say exercise is key, so I definitely recommend exercise. And then in addition, with a high visceral fat, I would say I would definitely check other cardiovascular disease risk factors. I would definitely be checking a high sensitivity CRP. I would definitely be doing an advanced lipid profile. I would definitely be checking an A1C. I would definitely be checking for other risk factors for cardiometabolic disease.
Love the protocol. Now, you mentioned something I wasn't even going to bring up, but it's something that's become pretty controversial in terms of cooking oils and high heat and low heat and cooking. It's something I never thought would be controversial. So, what is your approach in terms of, again, the ones that, I mean, we know seed oils are bad, and that's kind of, in most cases, they have the our highest inflammatory. But in terms of, again, this debate on olive oil and avocado oil in terms of the high cooking point. Do you have any opinion on this whatsoever that you tell your patients since you brought it up?
I definitely would say, generally speaking, I use olive oil in my cooking as like my staple. However, for high heat, it is not the best. Especially if you're living in New York City and you are cooking inside, you want to use an oil that's appropriate for a high heat so it doesn't smoke up your whole apartment. That's like an aside, but for the health benefits also, you want to make sure that you're using an oil that is not going to end up with things that actually could be bad for your health as a result of the high heat, right? And so I think it's important to recognize that there are different oils to use in different cooking scenarios. So for example, I love this. There's one recipe that's I don't know if you know the cook Ottolenghi, but I hope I'm saying his name correctly. But anyways, I have his cookbook. It's a great cookbook. There's a chicken dish I love, and he recommends sunflower seed oil for cooking the chicken, and you kind of like lightly, I would say brown the skin or fry the skin of the chicken before you put it in the oven, and it works perfectly. And so I use that, for example, because it's better with high heat. And then in the rest of the dish, I use olive oil. So I think one of the things I would say is that when you can try to use the right oil in the lowest doses possible, when it's not the preferred olive oil or preferred oil. I would say olive oil is the gold standard, best for heart health. And just be aware of it. Grilling in general is gonna, I would say, have some carcinogenic potential with anything that you put on the grill. So there's that. But trying to understand those risks and use the right oils, I think, is important. What about you? Do you?
I am a horrible cook. I'm that's my one of my resolutions this year is to like try to cook something better one time a week. Because our nanny and my wife are great cooks, and I just burn everything which has no taste, one or the other. So I am trying to learn. I am not. I couldn't name a chef that I follow. I wish I was that good, but that's my wife. I leave that to my wife, who's a great cook.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, so you have someone else managing it for you.
Exactly. No, I just I'm a good eater, and I try. I again, it's a resolution, especially my patients ask me something. If I can relate and figure out something that I can cook that's simple, anybody can do it. That's the way I look at it at
Well,
this point.
but you know what? You highlighted something that I think is really important, just not to harp on the oils for a second, but like it, whatever you're doing with your diet for anyone should be easy and approachable. So like if you have olive oil and that's all you have, cook with it. It's not the end of the world. Do you know what I mean? Like I think everyone can sometimes get too caught up in all of this stuff, and it's important to be mindful of your health, but also figure out what's sustainable and what fits with your lifestyle. That's really important, you know?
Exactly. I just that's the, we just end it right there, drop the mic, but we won't.
Yeah.
So we let everything we've kind of we laid the groundwork here because I know it's another kind of big part of your practice. Autoimmune disease kind of incorporates everything else that we've been talking about in terms of your gut health and weight and your insulin and your microbiome and all that kind of interplays into autoimmune diseases. And it's probably one of the biggest diseases where there's such a huge dichotomy between traditional medicine, where they're just going to put you on an immunosuppressant, and the way you approach an immune person with any type of autoimmune issue. So explain again, how do you look at patients who come in with an autoimmune issue? I know this depends on what they're presenting with.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, so a couple of things with an autoimmune condition. I always like to take the functional medicine approach of the root cause analysis. Can we figure out what the trigger is? Because most of the time, it's a multifactorial disease process, right? So it's epigenetic. It's, you maybe have a genetic predisposition, and then you've got all the environmental factors that then cause that disease to manifest most of the time, right? And so figuring out, like, was there an environmental stressor that caused that disease to present in your early 20s, for example, with when you started, you had your first, you know, psoriatic plaque, as an example, right? Because we've all seen that patient. And you're like, well, what is it that, you know, triggered your psoriasis to manifest right at that moment? It could be something emotional. It could be a physiological thing. It could be, you know, lifestyle. So those things are important. Definitely figuring out if there are specific food triggers. I usually would recommend a modified elimination diet if there's a concern that there could be specific food sensitivities triggering an autoimmune condition. Gut microbiome testing, as we talked about, or modifying, definitely considering a probiotic with a specific strain for that disease process, you know, that has data for it. Considering, I would say, anti-inflammatory supplements. So I mentioned ginger earlier, which I really like, especially with anyone who's having GI-related symptoms. I love a high omega-3 fatty acid, which we, you know, I mentioned before, but I think that's really great. I definitely like to recommend increasing prebiotics in the diet. And then I mentioned probiotics, but also fiber to help with, I would say, overall gut microbiome, can help in terms of regulation in terms of the gut and or any, you know, constipation or diarrhea, which sometimes can be associated with these autoimmune conditions. I really focus on stress management, sleep, exercise. I think exercise is probably one of the bigger things that goes under-treated with autoimmune conditions. I think, you know, exercise can be really good for regulating your immune system. It's really good for mental and physical health. And what I mean by that is, ultimately, in terms of even like with joint pain, you feel good when you move, and having a movement practice can be really good in terms of helping with connective tissue, helping with joint mobility, and then ultimately longevity. And that's another thing too, with weight and mobility. You know, one of the things that correlates most with longevity is really being able to be independent. And so that's something that I really try to focus on and highlight in the practice, is making sure that we have a lifestyle that's developed and created for each patient that they like and want to maintain, because that then is what's going to really help them have lasting health and wellness.
Love it. Now, you mentioned, again, we always talk about lab and data. Are you somebody who measures, goes down and measures the different types of omega fats, omega-3, 6, 9? Is that something that's part of, again, if you can, we'll put that in air quotes, kind of like we do with some of the other caveats.
Yeah, that's a good question. I feel like that's definitely something where, like, a, you know, kind of more traditional internal medicine doctor would, like, you know, be like, no, we're not doing that. And now is being done a little bit more and more, and even a more, you know, advanced lipid profile. But I think that I definitely would and do consider it for specific patients, depending on their disease process and other metabolic conditions. So I do think it can be really helpful in terms of taking a deeper look at overall gut health and then also supplementing correctly. But do you use it?
I'm a lab nerd at this point, and my patients kind of expect it from me that I'm going to, they like, oh, Paulvin's going to order every lab I need. So, but I do, I find it helpful for a lot of my patients. With some of them, everything from like the mitochondrial issues, and there's so many overlapping things from brain to mitochondria to everything that you mentioned, like joints and things. So I just use it. So I think it's helpful. It just comes, unfortunately, it's not used. Sometimes it's not covered by insurance. It's one of those things I kind of put on the back burner. I've also learned things I can kind of take off if patients, again, a la carte kind of gets expensive sometimes. So I'm always cognizant of that.
Well, I think that's the other thing too. You know, it's hard when you are really tied to what's covered with insurance. And so I think that that's part of the reason why in more traditional medical internal medicine practices, they're, you know, you're guided based on what's covered and then what's best in terms of population health outcomes, which is less of an individualized approach, right? And so there's no one right way, but it's just a different way to practice.
Exactly. Now, you mentioned prebiotics. It's become a pretty big buzzword. So what are prebiotics, for people who don't know, what are prebiotics? What are your go-to prebiotics? And when used with your patients?
Yeah, that's a great question. So prebiotics are either foods or supplements that actually are food for bacteria in your gut to break down and then help you foster a healthy gut microbiome. They can be really good for helping with short chain fatty acid production in your gut and butyrate and things of that nature, which are actually really good for your gut microbiome and for ensuring actually that you can extract all of the micronutrients and macronutrients that you need from the food that you eat. Typically, I really lean on dietary modifications before adding in a supplement because I tend to add a probiotic. So I don't always do a prebiotic and probiotic supplement. I really try to like cherry pick supplements as much as possible and do as much as we can with a whole food diet. So bananas, for example, are a great prebiotic. Now, they can spike blood sugar, so it's important to recognize that and eat them in the right combinations. But
you snuck it in there. Yeah, bananas for some reason are like the high sugar food. Yes, but
yeah,
in quotes.
But they're the low hanging fruit in terms of a prebiotic.
Nicely done. Nicely done.
So I'd say a lot of things in the diet I would probably recommend first. You know, if you can tolerate onions, things like that, I think that's another good prebiotic. Bananas, I already mentioned, but I think that it's also important to keep in mind things that might be triggering for patients. So that's why I said onions, and I was just sort of backing away from that because it can be triggering for people with IBS. And so definitely just like, you know, making sure that you know the patient that you're treating and then recommend the right prebiotics for them.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It's almost every food, it's a balance because, I mean, kefir, some people react to, a lot of the vegetables could be bloated. So you have to find that happy medium. And that's where I defer to people like you, nutritionists, because again, part of my, I'm not the best cook, so I don't know how to integrate different foods. I mean, obviously I can tell somebody to eat a banana, but again, I think it's important to, if in these type of situations where the basics don't work with somebody or a nutritionist who can find that mix and match, because it works for you is not going to work for your best friend. It's, again, we've gone through a lot of, it's microbiome or genetic related or epigenetics, and it's everything's individual, which we've kind of harped on through the whole thing here, which is insanely important. Now, you mentioned something, and I'm curious how your approach is. I'm a little more supplement than diet related. I do both, but is short chain fatty acids and butyrate, which are getting more and more publicity, we know, in terms of the benefits for the gut, the benefits for the brain. So how do you implement short chain fatty acids and butyrate in a diet perspective, from a diet point of view?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say a couple of things. So definitely focusing on the gut microbiome, which we talked about already, but that's a big thing in terms of making sure that you are getting all of those short chain fatty acids, eating a variety of foods, eating the rainbow, making sure that that you are, I would say, getting the right probiotics in your diet. So if you don't want to take a probiotic supplement, there's other things you can do. You can eat kimchi, you can eat fermented foods, you can, if you can tolerate dairy or other non-dairy yogurts, things like that, you can get a lot of healthy probiotics in your diet without needing to supplement. So those are a couple of things, but then also eating a lot of vegetables, you know, those are really good for helping your gut and the healthy bacteria that's in your gut actually make those short chain fatty acids, because that's what ultimately produces them, is the bacteria in your gut when it digests the food that you're eating. And then it allows the cells of your intestines to essentially absorb all of those micro and macronutrients that you need.
We're winding down. So what would you want people out there to know that we haven't talked about in terms of improving their health, or some tip that we haven't really delved into yet?
Yeah. I love to have a little like action item or takeaway point. So I would say three things, and we'll stay with three because I have three pillars of health. So three things I would say is consider how your diet, exercise, and nutrition are working together to impact your health, maybe positively or negatively. And I think that it's important to kind of marry those three things together, and more for them to or for you to recognize the synergy between all of them, because they're really all equally important in terms of your overall health. And recognizing that when you want to treat energy levels, like fatigue, for example, you want to treat a condition like PCOS, you want to treat a condition like obesity, or you want to treat hair loss, taking a multi-pronged approach will have a much bigger impact than typically just focusing on one area of your health. And so that's really the benefit of seeing someone who can put all of that together, and really understand what's going on in your body and in your life, so that then you can have a plan that's lasting and that ultimately sets you up for success.
Totally agree with everything you just said. So where I appreciate you coming on today. So let everybody know where they can find you, how they can connect you, website, YouTube. How do people find you and learn some insights from you that you put out there?
So you can find our practice on social, which is the Health Meets Wellness, or you can find me as Dr. Elizabeth Sharp on Instagram. And then we also have our website, so you can find us on there, and you can send us an email at info@healthmeetswellness.com. And my one takeaway, last point, would be eat the rainbow. It will definitely positively impact your health.
It's simple, and it's not a supplement. It's the best way to start. You got to start at the foundation. So again, Dr. Elizabeth Sharp, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate you. Give us some really great insight. Everything starts with the diet, but there's other new approaches out there to treat these things that we discussed. And we hope we'll see you again soon. Definitely check out our information on social media. It's really informative, from recipes to yoga. There's all these different pieces of information he puts out there are really helpful and very easy to use, which is great. So again, thanks for hopping on to the Life Optimized podcast. We're available on all podcast stations like Spotify and Apple, and we're on YouTube at Dr. Paulvin. So thanks for tuning in, and we will see you guys soon. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Whether you're an entrepreneur, a biohacker, or an athlete, if you're ready to take the next steps to optimize your life, visit drpaulvin.com. That's DrPaulvin.com.